Morning, everybody. Hope everybody had a great feast. You know, it was a very meaningful feast and one of the more fulfilling feasts that I've had in quite a while. So hopefully the same was true for you as well. Very interesting. This is going back into the archives of sermons, and I had picked this sermon out several weeks back. And it's very interesting how well it fits with current events, and I think you'll see that as we go through this. The title is Calamity! Exclamation point. Calamity. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? So those are the words of Epicurus, who's a Greek philosopher from Athens who lived about 300 years before Christ. And if you remember the account of Paul addressing the Areopagus, Mars Hill, in Acts 17, it mentions Epicurean philosophers, those who followed the thinking of Epicurus. And you can see that the questions and these accusations about God that Epicurus brings up, why does he allow evil to exist in the world? And why doesn't he make everything sunshine and rainbows? See, these thoughts have been around a long time. And Of course, Epicurus wasn't the first to ask them. But what do we say? What do we say to questions like this? Now, it's the second question that Epicurus asked that we're going to look at today in a specific light. And the question again is God able but not willing to prevent evil? And he asked that question, and then he follows it with an accusation. He says that if God is able to prevent evil, but he doesn't, then he says that God is malevolent, meaning that he is not an all-loving God. As with so many things, this is a very big subject that you can dig very deeply into, lots of layers, lots of different perspectives, but I think we're going to start here. We're going to lay down some basic ground rules that I think all of us, because we're gathered here today as a church, I think we can agree on these things here that we'll go over. The first is the two first sentences of the first fundamental belief of the United Church of God. If you go into our fundamental doctrine literature, it says, we believe in one God, the Father, eternally existing, who is a spirit, a personal being of supreme intelligence, knowledge, love, justice, power, and authority. He, through Jesus Christ, is the creator of the heavens and the earth and all that is in them. He is the source of life and the one for whom human life exists. So this fundamental belief, right at the outset, this is what it lays out. It says that God has supreme intelligence, knowledge, supreme love, supreme justice, power, and authority. We also see that as the creator, that he is both the source of life and the one for whom human life exists. So we see that God, because he is supreme in power, that he does indeed have the ability to prevent evil. He has the ability to prevent or to cause to happen anything that he would wish. And because he is also a being of supreme love, then evil exists because it has a purpose. Let's look at the source of evil again. This is from the fundamental beliefs of the United Church of God. It says, we believe that Satan is a spirit being who is the adversary of God and the children of God. Satan has been given dominion over the world for a specific time, Satan has deceived humanity into rejecting God and his law. Satan is ruled by deception with the aid of a host of demons who are rebellious angels, spirit beings who followed Satan in his rebellion. So now we've got this basic foundation. God is able to prevent evil. And the source of evil is Satan and his influence through attitudes, through deception. Now let's go back to Epicurus. Let's look at that accusation. If God is able to prevent evil, but he chooses not to, Epicurus accuses God of being malevolent. Now what does God say to that? Let's go to Isaiah 45. Let's go to Isaiah 45 for our first scripture today. In this chapter, we see the prophecy of God calling out Cyrus by name as a type of Messiah who would be performing God's will. Let's jump in at verse 5. Isaiah 45, verse 5. Now, in the King James Version, this is how it reads. It says, I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is... Is it not broadcasting? Boom.
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Isaiah 45, verse 5. I am the Lord, there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Verse 7. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. Now, most of you likely have the New King James Version. And you'll note that in that translation, it reads, I make peace and create calamity. And that is a more accurate word to use. When you look at the word that the King James Version translated as evil, you find that it's one of those Hebrew words that has a very wide range of meaning. And so we need to apply some context, both the surrounding verses as well as the general themes of the Bible, in order to accurately understand what the intended meaning of the word is. And for this verse, if you look at Barnes' notes, Barnes has this very helpful comment. It says, the parallelism here shows that this is not to be understood in the sense of all evil, but of that which is the opposite of peace and prosperity. That is, God directs judgments, disappointments, trials, and calamities. He has the power to suffer the mad passions of people to rage and to afflict nations with war. He presides over adverse as well as prosperous events. Now, many times when people make accusations against God, they're asking those same questions as Epicurus, they typically have in mind either the very large tragedies of humanity, wars, famines, refugee crises, mass destruction due to weather events. We have seen all of these things over this past year and even in the past week. Or they'll have seen or experienced tragedy on a personal level. Perhaps it was a severe illness or an untimely death of a loved one. And all of those things happen. And yes, they're terrible. They're terrible to see. They're terrible to experience. It is not a fun part of the human experience. And we know that much of it comes through the influence of Satan. But at the end of the day, responsibility for so much of it lies at the feet of men and women who make the choice to do evil rather than good. But we do see from what we read in Isaiah 45 that God does indeed make calamity. As Barnes' commentary said, that God directs the judgments, the disappointments, the trials, and calamities. That he presides over adverse as well as prosperous events. Now, why does he do such things? Why would God not only allow calamity, but to actually cause it to happen? Well, that's what we're going to take a look at now. Let's start by going over to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. We're going to pick up in verse 13. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 13 says, "Consider the work of God. For who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him." So what we see in Ecclesiastes is a confirmation of what we read in Isaiah 45, that surely God has appointed both the day of prosperity and adversity. God makes peace and calamity. But we also see in verse 13, there's a key concept in here. It says, "Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked?" Let's turn back a few pages in Ecclesiastes, back to the first chapter. Start reading in verse 12. It says, "I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of men, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind." Verse 15, "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered." So again, we see the statement that what is crooked cannot be made straight. And the things that mankind has made crooked, we can't straighten it out on our own. We end up just making it that much more crooked. And we see that what God makes crooked, there's no chance that we're ever going to make that straight. So what we're talking about here, all this talk of crooked and straight, peace and evil or calamity, and questioning, you know, whether or not God is malevolent for allowing evil to exist. What we're talking about here is direction. We're talking about God exercising his sovereign authority, his supreme power to take events out of the hands of man, to turn them upside down, to change our direction, to change the path that future events will take. And to understand that if we are looking at the big picture, that gives us assurance that God's plan of salvation will indeed be fulfilled. And there is nothing that mankind, Satan, or any event, there's nothing that's going to prevent that from taking place, just as was pointed out in the sermonette. Because God has both the power and the will to take action. And sometimes the form it takes is calamity. Let's look at some examples. Let's find out why God chose to act in the way that he did. So let's go back to the first place where the path was made crooked. Back in Genesis 1, we see that the creation of the heavens and the earth, including mankind, pick up in verse 29, we get these instructions to mankind. Genesis 1, verse 29, "And God said, see, I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food. Also to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the air, and everything that creeps on the earth, in which there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. And then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day." So it was very good. The path at this point was straight. Now let's skip over a couple of chapters to chapter 3. This is where we first see the influence of Satan and his lie to induce the first sin and rebellion against God. And mankind makes the path crooked. Mankind changes direction from obeying God to believing that they could choose their own path for themselves. And we've thought that way ever since. Every one of us started that way in our lives. And even when we've been following God for a long time, we can sometimes feel the pull to choose our own way instead of His. Let's look at what God did. Genesis 3, verse 16. What did God do? Did God let Adam and Eve just keep going down that path, that crooked path? No. God made them change direction. Let's see what this change of direction included. Genesis 3, verse 16. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And then to Adam he said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it, cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. So life was going to be much more difficult from this point forward, because there are consequences for the decisions that we make, for the path that we walk. So mankind was not able to continue on the original path that God had set them on. They had chosen another path for themselves. But God had, and He still has, a vision for mankind. He has an ultimate decision for us to strive for, and that is eternal life in the kingdom of God. And the path that Adam and Eve, and the one that every human being has since been choosing for themselves, that path will not lead us there. So God must change our direction. He must bend our path back toward Him and to our destiny. Now let's skip ahead in Genesis over to chapter 6. And we're going to see some calamity on a monumental scale. Genesis 6. Now most of us have computers, and we'll use them for work, we'll use them for personal use. How many of you have had the experience where you've been working on something for a long time? Maybe you've been writing a paper or putting together an analysis or a presentation for work, something along those lines. Maybe it's just a long email to a friend, but you've put in a lot of effort. And then the computer locks up on you, it freezes. And you haven't saved yet. I think most of us have had that experience, and there is nothing that you can do. There's nothing that you can do except to shut it down and restart it. And you know that all of the work that you've done up to that point is gone. It is not a fun experience. Well, imagine how God must have felt when He had to make the decision that we read about in Genesis 6, verse 5. And the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that He had made man on the earth. Another example of God changing His mind. And He was grieved in His heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So God had put in all of this work to create man, to give him the earth to work, to live in, to multiply, to have families, to experience life, to experience love. And God wanted to have a relationship with man. And again, everything had started out as being very good. But now, every intent of the thoughts of man was only evil continually. mankind had locked up, kind of like the computer. And there was no way at that point that the path that mankind was on at that time could ever lead to God. It was a complete and utter dead end. And so God had to hit the reset button on mankind by sending the flood, saving only 8 people to restart human civilization and to set it back on a path that could lead to the kingdom of God. Further on in Genesis, we read about Joseph. And we read about his rise to power in Egypt. And what is fascinating is that God worked through calamity on both a personal and a national scale to set the stage for future events. And it is incredible to see as we walk through this. Genesis 37. We start there, Genesis 37. And this is where we see the beginning of Joseph's story. We see that God gets the ball rolling here by sending Joseph dreams of greatness. Dreams that were not received exactly with enthusiasm by his family. Let's go to verse 23. Let's see where calamity enters Joseph's life. Genesis 37, verse 23. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. And then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. And then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. And then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Well, this is definitely a calamity for Joseph. But we know from the story that it was God who took Joseph's path and made it crooked. Later, we see there's another calamity that befalls Joseph. His Egyptian master, Potiphar, to whom he had been sold, he makes him chief servant of the household. Things are starting to look up, but Potiphar's wife attempts to seduce Joseph, and then when he refuses, she accuses him of doing what she had hoped that he would do. And Joseph has another calamity. He is cast into prison. And then those personal calamities that Joseph experienced, those calamities were followed by calamities on a national, even multinational scale. Let's read about that in Genesis 41. Joseph is pulled out of the prison to interpret Pharaoh's dreams that he had. Verse 25. Genesis 41, verse 25. After Pharaoh had described his dreams, Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do." There's going to be some calamity coming. "The 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good cows, or the 7 good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one, and the 7 thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years, and the 7 empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe." And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So a calamity of epic proportions is coming. And Joseph tells Pharaoh in verse 32 that this is established by God, and that God himself would bring it to pass, and that there is nothing that anyone could do that was going to prevent what was coming. And it was through that calamity that Egypt would be set up as a superpower of the ancient world. And Joseph, of course, gives solid advice for weathering this coming calamity. Verse 33. Now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this. And let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the seven plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh. And let them keep food in the cities. And then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. So the famine did come, just as Joseph had interpreted, and calamity fell upon the entire region. And let's look at how this calamity set up Egypt as a superpower. Verse 46, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Now in the seven plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all of the food, of those 7 years which were in the land of Egypt and laid up the food in the cities. He laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. So because of this foresight of Jesus or of Joseph through God showing him what was to come, Egypt was the only nation in the region that was prepared. And now let's see the result of this calamity, this crooked spot in the road that God used to redirect the path of history. Break into verse 54. The famine was in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, and whatever he says to you, do. And the famine was over all the face of the earth. And Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all lands. Now, throughout this, we see the story of how Jacob's sons came to Joseph to buy grain, how he eventually revealed himself to them, how Israel came to settle in the land of Goshen, in the choicest of all the land of Egypt. But the famine was still going on. So let's move to Genesis 47. Genesis 47, this is where we see Joseph is dealing with the famine some more. Verse 13, now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So now what we're seeing is that the monetary system is collapsing in the region, because Pharaoh now has all the money. All the gold, all the silver, anything that's being used for money is being brought into the treasury of Pharaoh. And for the people, what does that matter? You can't eat money. Grain has become far more important for survival than money. Verse 15. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread. For why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed. And then Joseph said, give your livestock, and I will give bread for your livestock if the money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the cattle of the herds, and for the donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. So now the Egyptians, and you would expect the other nations in the area surrounding Egypt, now they're out of money. Now they're exchanging their livestock. You know, after all, if you're out of money, you can't feed yourself or your family. And livestock, that's just more mouths to feed. You better sell them while you're still alive. and can get something to try to feed your family. And now we read in verse 18, continuing on, it says, when that year had ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my Lord that our money is gone. My Lord also has our herds and our livestock. There's nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. So then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every man of the Egyptians sold his field, because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. So at this point, Egypt had become an all-powerful state. All of the land and even the people within it, it all belonged to Pharaoh. But Joseph provided some wisdom to prevent all-out abuse of the people by instituting a flat tax system. Verse 25. So they said, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh should have 1/5, 20% flat tax, except for the land of the priests only, which did not become Pharaoh's. So we see that through this calamity, God brought Egypt to the forefront of power in the world at that time. And at the same time, he provided a safe haven for Israel to grow. But he also set Israel on a path that would set the stage for a future calamity. Let's go to Exodus chapter 1, verse 6. Joseph died, all his brothers and all that generation, but the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. So this new Pharaoh, he's determined to take the children of Israel down a path of slavery and hardship. And if we continue on into Exodus, we see that those hardships were not just physical, but they were also great emotional hardship. I don't think we can even imagine living in conditions where your newborn son could be taken away from you and killed. It's very difficult for us to wrap our heads around something like that happening today. Now, for the sake of time, we're not going to go through all of the details of the plagues that God brought upon Egypt, but let's remember the circumstances in which it happened. We saw how God caused the rise of Egypt to superpower status through a series of calamities that he had ordained to happen. He had used the famine to do that, and Egypt had served its purpose then, and now it would serve another purpose. It would be the delivery of Israel and the destruction of Egypt as a superpower. Now, it would certainly remain powerful for a long time afterward, but God would make sure that it would not attain to its former heights. So let's survey some of the calamities that God brought to make sure of it. Exodus 7. The first plague was turning the waters of the Nile to blood. Let's go to Exodus 7, verse 20. Moses and Aaron did so just as the Lord commanded. So he lifted up the rod and struck the waters that were in the river in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants. And all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood. And the fish that were in the river died. The river stank. And the Egyptians could not drink the water of the river. So now we've got a major food source being destroyed. And in Exodus 9, we also read of the livestock of Egypt being struck with disease. And they were dying. So we've got this major blow to the food sources of Egypt, both directly through meat as well as agriculturally. You know, remember, the oxen would be used to help plow the fields, tread the grain. They would also be a source of milk. We also read in the same chapter of the destruction of those fields by hail. And then in Exodus 10, locusts come and eat whatever was left after the hail. Now, this is a dreadful level of destruction. The major sources of food have all been destroyed. And on top of that, God threw some boils in to make sure that people were just flat out miserable and they would be unable to work. So this now is a nation that is in economic freefall. And then God brings two more plagues that attack the spirit and the heart. First was an all-encompassing darkness, and then the death of the firstborn. And then, just when you think that it couldn't get worse for the nation of Egypt, Pharaoh decides that he is going to chase after Moses and the Israelites. And his army perished in the Red Sea. Now imagine what that would mean. If our U.S. armed forces were destroyed, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, all of it gone, how much power would we have as a nation? How much power would the president have? In ancient Egypt, the impact would have been even more. Because remember that Pharaoh was believed to be a god. And with the destruction of his army, Egypt was left physically and economically devastated, undefended, and now with a powerless leader. So this is calamity on a grand scale. It's a major turning point in the path of history. Now, there's many, many more points in history than we can find in the Bible where God used calamities on both a personal and as a national scale to turn the direction of events, to change that path. But what does it mean for us? How do we bring this to a personal level? You are going to have people who will look at this, and Epicurus, he would be included in this group. They would, you know, remember those questions that we quoted at the beginning of the message. They would look at the flood as an example, and they would say, wait a second, you're telling me that God is omnipotent. You're saying that God knows everything, and you're telling me that he is all-powerful. He can do anything. And you're telling me that he is all-loving, right? You're telling me that God is all of these things. So explain to me how this all fits together with God destroying virtually all life on the earth through the flood. Explain to me how God could order the wholesale destruction, the slaughter of entire peoples, as we read about in Joshua and in other places. How does that all fit in with love? If God is an all-powerful and all-loving being, then why did he not change the situation in some other way? In fact, how can a loving, all-powerful, and omnipotent God be put into such a situation in the first place? Well, the answer is free will. That is the key for us. Free will. The choices that we and all other human beings make, they determine the path that we are on, both as individuals as well as nations. And without the ability to make these choices, we're simply robots programmed to do as God wills. And if that was the case, then God would prevent evil. He would simply just not allow that choice to exist at all. But we have free will. We have the ability for each of us to make choices. And that must include the ability for us to make the wrong choice. And those wrong choices can and they will lead us on a path away from God and from the ultimate destiny that he has determined for all of humanity. And the path that you are on right now, at this very moment, that path is the collection of choices that you have made in your life. Every choice that you've made has a consequence. And some of them have been major. Some of them seem inconsequential, but if you add up enough of them, you see that many times those little decisions have just as much or maybe even more impact in your life. So here's the question. Are you on a path that will lead to God and His kingdom? And if you talk to enough people in the church, especially those who have been around for many years, you will hear stories of calamity. You'll hear of jobs lost, of broken families and other tragedies, personal calamities. You'll hear the stories of the scattering of the church, a calamity that was set in motion. And it's a calamity that set in motion the formation of the church organization of which we're a part today. And you're going to hear these stories, and with some time and some perspective, you see that these were turns of the path where a major change needed to be made. And God used a calamity to both draw attention and to force a decision. And the proof that it works is that many of these people are with us today. They went through the calamity, they learned from it, they made choices of their free will. A few years ago, I gave a sermon surrounding these calamities in Joseph's life and was showing how each of those calamities were opportunities for him to grow and how we can learn from that and to grow as leaders. And remember, that is what we are ultimately called to be. We are called to be leaders in the kingdom of God. So let's see what Joseph had to say to his brothers about the calamities that he had in his life. Genesis 45, verse 5. As you're turning there, let's remind ourselves of what we can read in Romans 8:28. And again, we're turning to Genesis 45. But Romans 8:28, you know, Paul, he had a lot of calamity going on in his life, but he said, "We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose." And we see this in Genesis 45 and verse 5. This is where Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Does my father still live?' But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, 'Please come near to me.' So they came near. And then he said, 'I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt.'" There may be calamities in our lives, but God gives us peace when we keep in mind that he is in charge. Whatever we are going through, if we stay on the path of following God, of loving him, following his way of life, just like with Joseph, we will have things work out in ways that we could never imagine. Because God does make all things work together for good, even if it first shows up in your life as a calamity. Let's go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 7 as we close. Think about this wisdom that can help us put whatever we've considered today into perspective. Again, Ecclesiastes 7, verse 13. "Consider the work of God." We need to look at our lives and see where God is working. "For who can make straight what he has made crooked?" It's another way of saying that we need to learn to not fight against what God is working to accomplish in your life. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. So it is a great source of assurance for us that God has things well in hand in the events of the world and in your life as well. We must ponder the path of our feet and know that if calamity befalls you, that it very well may be God tapping you on the shoulder to get your attention, and perhaps to force you to make a decision. And that is a decision that he intends to put you on a path to lead you to him.